From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, a convicted murderer asks that his victim's sexual history be made public. The New Hampshire Supreme Court is about to decide on an appeals case that could change 40 years of rape shield laws.
No state in the country peels away rape shield protections when a case reaches the Supreme Court level.
We'll talk to lawyers on both sides of this potentially history-making case. And people are living longer and delaying some milestones like marriage, childbearing, and retirement. So how is that changing how we work? Plus, a new study out of Brigham and Women's Hospital suggests radiologists might be able to detect breast cancer in the blink of an eye.
And if they were just guessing in a half second, they would be just as likely to say abnormal to a normal one as to an abnormal one. But in fact, they could beat chance very reliably.
That's all next on Radio Boston. First the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll begin today in New Hampshire, where the state Supreme Court is deciding a case that victims' rights advocates say could undo more than 40 years of work on rape shield laws. The court is considering whether to unseal details of a victim's sexual history, effectively making them public. So some background here. In 2014, Seth Mazzaglia was convicted of strangling 19-year-old Lizzie Marriott to death and then raping her. Mazzaglia was found guilty and sentenced to life in prison. During the trial, he claimed that Marriott died during consensual rough sex, and the defense wanted to introduce additional material about Marriott's past to support that claim. However, the judge in the initial trial ruled that under New Hampshire's rape shield law, Marriott's sexual history was not relevant to the case. Well, Mazzaglia's attorney is contesting that decision upon appeal, arguing that Marriott's sexual history should be unsealed and made public. The New Hampshire Supreme Court ordered the information unsealed on June 10th, that happened a little earlier, but stayed its own order soon thereafter, agreeing to keep it sealed until oral arguments next month. So a lot could happen on this case in September. Right now, we're going to hear from both attorneys in this case. First, Christopher Johnson. He's New Hampshire's chief public appellate defender. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
So first of all, make your argument to us. Why do you think Marriott's sexual history should be made public during the appeals process?
Well, I think there's two misconceptions that people need to understand about this. So the first misconception is about what the rape shield law is and what it isn't. What it is not is a principle that prior consensual sexual behavior of a complainant is never admissible in court. That is not the rule. The rule is that such information is presumptively inadmissible, but when the defendant's constitutional right to a fair trial requires that it be admitted, it has to be admitted. We don't do unfair trials in this country, not on purpose. And so when the fairness of the trial requires that the jury hear the information, they have to hear it. So now in this case, what happened was in the Superior Court, the trial court, there was a lengthy discussion about certain evidence that the defense said had to be admitted for Mr. Mazzaglia's trial to be fair.
Okay.
The trial judge ended up disagreeing with that. And in that issue, the rightness or wrongness of the trial court's ruling is the exclusive subject of Mr. Mazzaglia's Supreme Court appeal.
Are you at liberty to tell us anything about the details of that decision or the specifics of Lizzie Marriott's sexual history that could help us understand why you're making the argument that it is relevant?
Right. No, and that's exactly the point. No, I'm not. And that gets to my second point about, I think, what's not really that precisely understood here, is there is a procedural novelty that is being proposed in this case, but it is not by the defense. It has always been true that information about prior consensual sexual history is treated outside the presence of the public in the trial court, but not on appeal. So we're not trying to change anything about the way rape shield law has worked procedurally in New Hampshire forever. We just want the same process that defendants have always in the past had when they appeal, arguing that a trial judge's ruling made their trial unfair.
As you well know, there are many people who disagree with you. I mean, there's a lot of folks who say that the rape shield laws were put into place to make the entire system of criminal justice, whether or not be initial trials or appeals, less traumatizing to victims and their families. And this could overturn that. This could establish a precedent in opposition to that.
Well, that's where I disagree. I don't think that's right. It has always been true that these matters have been conducted secretly in trials, but not secretly on appeals. If you look at New Hampshire published Supreme Court opinions on Rape Shield issues, you will see in them described the content of the information that was at issue.
Okay. Well,
so
but
we are not talking about changing the Rape Shield protection as it applies in trials.
I see. So you want the information to be public so that everyone can see the reasoning behind the justice's decision?
Right. Usually, in any kind of a case, you go to the New Hampshire Supreme Court clerk's office and you say, I'm interested in State of New Hampshire versus so-and-so. I'd like to see what the lawyers are arguing in that case. Can you give me the file? And they will say yes, and you will find in that file detailed written arguments that the lawyers have filed explaining why the trial was unfair, and detailed written arguments why that the state has filed in defense of the correctness of the trial judge's rulings. In Mr. Mazzaglia's case, you go, I mean, this is not records we're talking about or some sort of therapeutic documents. We're talking about the legal arguments the parties have made. So if you go to the Supreme Court and say, I'd like to see the file, but the legal arguments in the Mazzaglia case, they will say, no, you can't see them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and maybe most important, in this case, if I don't win, if Mr. Mazzaglia doesn't win his appeal, when that opinion comes out, it's going to say, Mr. Mazzaglia has made some arguments about certain evidence which we are not at liberty to describe. We therefore cannot explain in public our reasons for rejecting those arguments. However, we can let you all know that we have, if it goes this way, affirmed his conviction and his sentence for life in prison without possibility of parole. Under separate order, we'll issue an opinion that actually explains the reasoning, but that will be available only to the lawyers.
Yeah. Let's get down to the heart of the matter about why this is drawing so very much attention, let alone the potential legal precedent set here. I mean, you are tasked with defending the appeals process of a client who was convicted of strangling a young woman and then raping her. I mean, should her personal life, her sexual history become a matter of public record, she is no longer here to defend herself or to dispute that record. I mean, that's kind of fundamentally what some people are so objecting to.
Yeah.
Your client is convicted of having committed a horrible crime.
Well, so two things I would say about that. First is, you know, our legal system wouldn't be worth the paper it's written on if it were not the case that even the least popular of us have a fundamental right to fair process. And that's all I'm asking for Mr. Mazzaglia, a fair appellate process, the same appellate process anybody else gets. My second point would be, you know, the concerns you have raised about Ms. Marriott's privacy are absolutely legitimate and are not in dispute. I mean, yes, her privacy has significant value, and it is what makes this a difficult question. My point is, and I think the other side seems not to appreciate this or agree with it, is that there is also, you know, if we elevate privacy above fairness and give him this sort of second-class secret, you know, public is excluded from appellate process, that also is a cost that has to be weighed in the balance.
Well, Chris Johnson is New Hampshire's chief public appellate defender. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And just a point of clarification, Johnson is actually seeking to overturn his client's conviction as part of this appeal. Well, we're joined now by Meg Garvin, who represents the Marriott family. She's also executive director of the National Crime Victim Law Institute and a professor at Lewis and Clark Law School in Portland, Oregon. Meg Garvin, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
So first of all, give me your reaction to how Christopher Johnson ended that conversation, basically saying that, you know, that he sees that that there's a tension between privacy and his client's right to a fair appeals process, and he worries that privacy is trumping his client's rights.
Well, certainly respect the notion of fair trial, fair appellate process. All of that is absolutely critical to a proper functioning system, and the Marriott certainly recognize that. What I think is being misunderstood here is that protecting of privacy, particularly when that privacy is about irrelevant information, i.e., prior sexual history that has already been ruled on multiple times to be irrelevant to the case at hand, protecting that privacy is, in fact, what is fair here. So I don't think there's a conflict between privacy and fairness. In fact, at times, the protection of privacy is what is most critical to a fair process. Otherwise, what we have is one person impacted by this crime, i.e., the defendant getting fairness, and the victim, also the person impacted by the crime, not getting fairness. When we think about fundamental fairness, it has to be to everyone in the system, and we have to pay attention to it equally for everyone. And here that demands privacy over irrelevant information.
Well, what's your view of what Johnson told us about that there's, quote, a procedural novelty being proposed here, and he says it's not being proposed by the defense, that the rules in New Hampshire have, in his words, always been different on appeal, and that information, trial information that was sealed and secret in the initial trials, don't necessarily have to be secret on appeal. He says that that's an extant tradition in New Hampshire.
Well, a couple of things with regard to trial-level protections and appellate-level protections. First and foremost, one of the things that's not being talked about sufficiently in this case is that in addition to Rape Shield, there are straight crime victims' rights provisions at stake here. And included in those are the right of victims to be treated with fairness and with respect for their dignity and privacy, quote, throughout the criminal justice process, end quote. That's black-letter law in New Hampshire. And that has not been sufficiently analyzed in prior cases. What does it mean to protect privacy throughout the criminal justice process? So that's one piece that this court is actually going to entertain arguments and consider what is the weight of that provision that really just hasn't been presented in the past. The second thing is what we have in place in this case are sealed documents, sealed conversations, sealed arguments, arguments that were made to the court. And so what we have in place is a trial court that put in place a seal. And so what is currently being litigated is, does that seal stay in place during the pendency of the appellate court process until the court determines whether the trial court erred or not? So fundamentally what's at stake is, do you unseal everything now, even though maybe the trial court properly sealed it, or do you wait and analyze whether the trial court erred or not?
Okay, so in other words, on the 21st of September, when the New Hampshire State Supreme Court hears oral argument, they're going to be hearing about this question of sealing, maintaining the seal or unsealing these aspects of the initial trial that had to do with Lizzie Marriott's personal life. And this conversation is happening before the merits of the appeal itself are going to be discussed before the state Supreme Court.
Correct.
Does that trouble you?
Well, it certainly puts the horse before the cart, or however that
expression goes. The cart before
the
horse, yeah.
Cart before the horse, yeah. The horse before the cart would be proper. It really is backwards, because what you want to do is make sure that everyone's rights are protected to the greatest extent possible, right, until there's a moment when you have to prioritize. What happened here is that privacy prevailed at the trial court level, including through a seal of documents. What is happening later in September is just an analysis of, do you keep those sealed for now? Right? Now, the Marriotts would certainly argue that they should never come out. They've been ruled irrelevant, right? And truthfully, prior sexual history of victims is irrelevant. Who I had sex with this morning is not relevant to whether I'm raped this afternoon. I mean, that's a fundamental premise of Rape Shield. That would be the Marriott's position. However, minimally, you're putting the cart before the horse if you say, well, let's unseal it now, even though we're not talking about the merits yet. And that just shouldn't happen.
Well, say that come September, following these oral arguments in New Hampshire, just say, hypothetically, that the New Hampshire State Supreme Court decides to maintain the seal. Then would this all have been blown over and no harm or damage done to this 40-year body of Rape Shield law that people are now highly concerned about?
Well, if it all stays sealed, hopefully that does mean ultimately that there's a recognition of the respect that Rape Shield put in place for privacy rights, right? Rape Shield is just a device for protecting fundamental privacy, which the U.S. Supreme Court has recognized exists in the U.S. Constitution. So if it stays in place, then what will have happened is a recent court will have re-recognized the importance of privacy in the proper functioning of our justice system.
And if it doesn't stay good. And if it doesn't stay in place?
Then I think the country as a whole needs to be a little concerned about what does this mean for sexual assault victims? What does it mean for anyone who wants to access the justice system? Is the price that you have to pay for accessing justice that your entire life, including allegations that you contest, is that all going to be put on parade in an internet age when it will live on in perpetuity? That is too high of a price for people to pay for accessing justice. So if it goes that way, I think we have some serious consideration as a country about, are there additional laws we need to put in place to ensure that privacy is intact?
Well, Meg Garvin is co-counsel for the family of Lizzie Marriott. She's also executive director of the National Crime Victim Law Institute and a professor at Lewis and Clark Law School in Portland, Oregon. Meg Garvin, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
And as we said, the New Hampshire State Supreme Court is set to hear oral arguments on this case on September 21st. We'll be definitely keeping our eye on what transpires there. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. On average, this might not be news, but on average, Americans are living longer, and therefore we're seeing all sorts of trends towards doing things later in life. People are pushing off marriage, they're having children later, and they're retiring from the workforce later as well. Now, the trends are so pronounced that writers Rosalind Barnett and Carol Rivers are now calling the ages of 65 to 80 a new stage of adulthood. And it's having a powerful impact on how everyone, regardless of how old you are, how everyone lives and works. Well, Rosalind Barnett is a senior scientist at Brandeis University's Women's Studies Research Center, and Carol Rivers is a professor of journalism at Boston University's College of Communication. Their new book is The Age of Longevity, Reimagining Tomorrow for Our New Long Lives, and they join us in the studio. Welcome back to Radio Boston, both of you.
Thank you
very much.
Okay, so we're not afraid of numbers or studies here at Radio Boston. So walk us through some of the data that drew you to this conclusion that the ages of 65 to 80 are a new stage of adulthood.
Well, I think part of our culture is that people retire at 65, and that's sort of Eric Erickson's thought about it's the era where people's kind of, they're no longer creative, they're summing up their lives, they're sort of facing death. And we kind of, all of us, not all of us, but most people, sort of have lived their lives that way. 65 is somehow a magic date. And people, in fact, are living and doing things in their 60s and 70s that aren't expected. You know, we have people that are very creative people, they're scientists doing productive work, and you read about these stories sort of one at a time, but mm-hmm. we put it all together and said, wait a minute now, it isn't just the odd person that's being productive into the 7th and 8th decade, but lots of people, and maybe this, we're into a new phase altogether.
For example, we find that entrepreneurs over 55 outnumber, you know, the young Turks who are supposed to be in their garages at 20 starting these big companies. So, you know, the gray entrepreneurs are very real, and there's lots of them.
Right. So, and also, I mean, you had some interesting numbers about the percentage of people in different age cohorts who are in the workforce. And in fact, we've seen, do I have this right, that 55 and above, we've actually seen a growth in that percentage?
Yes, it's the fastest growing segment of the labor force.
The fastest growing segment is 55 and above.
Mm-hmm. It's quite astonishing, actually.
No one would think that. We all think that the 55 and above people are all retiring. They're all going out to the sunset and playing golf. Not so much. More and more people are staying in the workforce.
Okay. No, go ahead.
And they're working full time. For a lot of people, the notion of an older worker is someone standing at Walmart greeting people or working part-time here and there, but that's not the case.
Right. Well, so my initial reaction to that is, okay, wow, interesting, but B, is it because they have to post-2008 and everyone's 401ks got wiped out, so they got to stay in the workforce longer?
Well, certainly that's a part of it. But there are, for a lot of people, they get a satisfaction out of work, and it structures their lives, and they're doing meaningful work. When it stops being meaningful, then maybe reconsider. But while they're being productive, that's what they want to be doing.
And one thing that we know is that people are living longer, healthier. And there's a theory called compression of morbidity. And what that means is, in the old days, you were 65, you started this long, slow decline. Mm-hmm. And nowadays what we're seeing is that people are living healthier longer, so maybe you are working and working creatively and doing great stuff until you're 85 or 90, and then bang, the steep decline comes. So we have this whole new period of time in which people are functioning at a fairly high level and are fairly healthy.
My dad always says he wants to pop rather than deflate.
Exactly.
Sounds like that's what you're talking about.
Right, that's it.
Okay. Now, you also have some interesting data on that seems to refute some other preconceived notions we may have of people 65 and older about their effectiveness in the workplace as well, such as productivity or consistency in work mm-hmm. versus younger workers. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that.
Well, it's pretty interesting. People expect that if workers are older workers, they'll be falling off, not being as productive, and being out sick. It turns out that the data don't show that, and the theory behind that is that older people are more focused, they're less distracted, they can draw on their experience of developing strategies that work for them, and they're more productive than younger workers.
More productive?
More productive.
Okay. All of a sudden, I'm feeling inadequate all of a sudden. I don't mean to make light of this because it is a serious issue that's really changing how we live. But there's one thing that I did want to underscore, and that's another statistic that you bring up in the book, The Age of Longevity. And that is because people are living longer, one of the reasons maybe not so happily that keeps them in the workforce is that they're quite frankly just worried about running out of money, that they don't have the retirement savings.
That's certainly real. When you look at people that, you know, once when you were 65, the idea is, okay, you're going to live two or three more years, this is fine. But if you're 65 and you're looking at retirement and you're thinking, I might live another 20, 25 years, and then you say, do I have the finances for that? And if you don't have the finances for that and you are healthy, that's a pretty good motivation for staying in the workforce.
In fact, there's some data that show that older people are more afraid of running out of money than they are afraid of dying.
Right.
And it's really very dramatic.
Right. Well, I want to dig into more about the funding retirement question with you guys in just a minute. But we're speaking with Roslyn Barnett and Carol Rivers. Their new book is The Age of Longevity, Reimagining Tomorrow for Our New Long Lives. And the way that the increasing numbers of people 55 and 65 and older are staying in the workforce and staying active in the workforce, how that's changing how all of us live. And I'm wondering if you've been seeing that in your own lives. I mean, how are our new long lives affecting you and your family? Do you see it in your own workplace? Do you see more older workers contributing longer? Is that a good thing for where you work? Is it not a good thing? Are you a younger worker who's glad to have the mentorship and experience of older workers in your workplace? Or are you wondering when you'll ever be able to get promoted if so many people who are older are staying in the workplace? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Would love to hear why people 65 and older out there are staying in work longer than ever. So Roslyn and Carol, we've sort of gone over some of the numbers here. Tell us, in your research, what have you found about how this generation of people who are living longer and working longer, how they're actually changing the workplace?
Well, there are a lot of different ways. Let me see where to start. For one thing, we have a four-generational workforce now. So you have people who are working for people much younger than they are, for example, and there's new notions like reverse mentoring, where younger people are mentoring older senior people. with this exchange between the generations in terms of skills, where younger workers may be more savvy with respect to some technology issues. Older workers may have more corporate memory, and they're finding ways to interact and promoting age diversity, which is very important, because another thing we haven't talked about yet is that demographically, we have a declining fertility rate in this country, which means that every cohort will be smaller than the one preceding it. And corporations are understanding that now. So they're working to retain older workers because the younger workforce is smaller. So you're going to have a much more age-diverse workplace, and that's already happening.
And so the idea of, you know, people being, younger people being pushed out, it's a phony war because, in fact, there are going to be a lot fewer younger workers. So the older workers are going to be enhancing the workplace, and they're not going to be pushing all these younger workers out because there's just fewer babies being born and fewer younger workers out there.
Yeah. But do you think businesses are recognizing this? Because I think, I mean, there's a lot of, ageism baked into how companies hire. I mean, you know, on this show, we've talked to people who, you know, for example, look at tech companies or Silicon Valley, and they say, look, you know, the minute you get over, I don't know, age 40, suddenly you become far less desirable as a prospective employee.
No doubt. And I think ageist attitudes are part of it. But I think things are changing because some companies are actually spending more money now in recruiting older workers than they are younger workers. So it's not across the board by any means, but it is happening.
And I think particularly like in tech, people are recognizing, okay, maybe the older workers aren't going to have the most up-to-date zippy-zap skills, but they're going to know things like how do you manage if you're in a problem? What's the institutional history of this company? How have people done things before to make it work? And if you just throw out all your institutional memory, then you're stuck with knowing nothing about the past.
Mm-hmm. So tell me more about then how, I mean, we talked about mentorship and things like that. Are there ways that maybe are not so positive that this cohort is having an impact on the workplace?
We haven't read anything.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure it's because the researchers haven't been looking at that or what. But the bigger story from the work that we reviewed was that there's a positive impact. And one of the things that's coming up, a whole line of other work, is how workplaces can adapt to make it more comfortable for older workers. So, for example, with relatively minor adjustments and having people sit rather than stand or stand on a platform instead of made out of wood rather than concrete or just simple things like that, which are really low-cost changes, have huge returns in terms of productivity. Mm-hmm. So there's a bunch of work out there now on those kind of factors.
Yeah, and one thing we now do know is that cognitive skills do not decline as fast as we thought, that when you start looking at this new research on older workers, their cognitive skills are quite high. So it isn't like, you know, that they're the old gray mares of the workforce, dumb, dull, et cetera, that they're very much capable of functioning at a high level cognitively.
Right.
One of the things that's interesting along those lines, the fact that older workers may not know something doesn't mean they can't know it.
Yeah.
I think that's easy to confuse. You may see an older worker who's not doing X and say, oh, well, he's just too old. But they haven't learned it. And if they can learn, and they do perform.
Now, are we talking about jobs that are mostly white-collar jobs? Because what about all the jobs out there that involve a great deal of physical labor and that just, you know, once workers get past a certain age, maybe they just don't, they retire because, A, they don't want to do the jobs anymore because they're just too physically demanding.
Well, I think a lot of jobs these days are not that physically demanding as they might have been. So, yes, that's probably true, but there are very few jobs that require people to work 40 hours a week doing hard physical labor.
Right. You're not going to see very many, 80-year-old firefighters or cops. But you're going to see, as the workplace becomes more technological, you're going to see people who can very easily handle some of these chores because they're not going out climbing ladders or, you know, running after, crooks. They're doing things that are well within their skill level.
Hmm. Well, so that's a socioeconomic question. What about, I mean, there's also, is there not a question about race here? I mean, are we seeing people of all races and ethnicities staying in the workforce longer or not?
The data so far that we've seen really doesn't break things out by race. So I think it's more like by occupation.
And by socioeconomic level, it's really very clear that if you have the people who are less educated, they have only high school degrees. If they're poor, they probably have more things like more diabetes and all of these kinds of things. So what we worry about is we're seeing this huge gap in aging where you have the privileged, happy elders, if you will. But then looking across the spectrum, you also see the worry about people who, you know, don't have these kind of advantages and don't kind of have that kind of health and that kind of education. And they tend to often to have real problems.
Well, so this is an extraordinarily important point, I think, right? Because is another way of what you're saying, is another way of putting it, is that this is we can see yet another form of inequality forming among
Absolutely.
People 65 and older then?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So older people who have benefited by having educational and other kind of resources are going to have a more productive and a fulfilled older life. So it just speaks to straightening out the equality issues early on so everyone can enjoy the fruits of the longer extra years. You know, we're living about 30 years longer, more or less, than we did like a half a century ago. Mm-hmm. And not everyone is going to find those years to be productive. And we can do something about that.
Sure. If you can go to a gym and you can go buy, you know, good food at an expensive supermarket and you don't get these kind of diseases that come from, you know, living in poverty for a long time, you may have, your later years are going to be fun, interesting, productive, etc. But if you are poor, there's not a lot of chance that you're going to get the same kind of opportunity.
Well, we're speaking with Rosalind Barnett and Carol Rivers. Their new book is The Age of Longevity, Reimagining Tomorrow for Our New Long Lives. And by the way, I should mention they're going to be at the Harvard Bookstore tomorrow night, and we're taking your calls for them. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Are you staying in the workforce longer than you initially anticipated? And are you staying in the workforce longer out of choice or maybe because you have to? And for people of any age, how do you see or how are you seeing this age of longevity changing your workplace and how we work? Again, we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Let's go to John, who's calling from Gloucester. You're on the air, John.
Hi. I think I would say that I've got a bit of a different take on this, and that I'm a middle-aged guy who's sort of stuck because a lot of folks I work with who've done zero in the way of financial planning are staying on, not being particularly productive, but just waiting it out. And, you know, kind of call them retired at the place. And I think in some ways that can stifle, opportunity and creativity because their skills have collapsed and they're not really doing a whole lot.
John, looks like we're losing your cell phone signal there. I'm sorry about that, but I think I got from John that he's at least in a workplace right now that is getting older, but isn't seeing the kind of turnover that maybe the business needs. Is that we touched upon that earlier? Is that a problem?
Well, it can be. Look, there are always people who are not doing their job, who are slackers, but they're among the young people as well as among the older people. So I think that what the research tells us is that it's not at all inevitable that your older workers are going to be those kind of slackers, that the evidence is that the chances are that they're going to be productive and useful. But everybody, of course not.
Hmm. Well, let's go to Bill, who's calling from Somerset. You're on the air, Bill.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can. What's your thought?
Good. Well, just briefly about myself, I'm 62. I worked for 30 years for large companies in the financial sector. I saved from my 401k. I supported a family. I paid off a house. I did what I was taught to do as a child. And then it stopped becoming fun. And when I was laid off at 62, I said, this is an opportunity to become a child again almost. And so I went back to a community college in Massachusetts where tuition and fees over 60 years old is free. And I completed an organic farming certification course. So to re-educate at 60 and 62, it allows you to look at life differently. You've accomplished so much. And you are such experienced from being in corporate America.
Right.
30 years in total quality.
And you took that experience into farming. Bill, thank you so much. Well, I'm gonna take it back from you, Bill, here. Thanks so much for your call. But Rosalind and Carol, what do you hear in Bill's story?
Exactly what we're talking about, that instead of retiring students saying, oh, well, you know, I'm through, I'm not going to do anything creative, I'm going to go sit, you know, look at the sea or take walks. He says, hey, this is as he said, I can become a child again. I can learn something new. So I think this is exactly the kind of thing we're seeing in this stage we call late adulthood, of people, you know, being adventuresome, doing new things, and not just sort of dying on the vine.
Yeah. But, on the other hand, I hear Bill's story saying that he was one of those people who was capable because he had the financial means of doing so. Because in your book, you also point out that, for example, people 55 and older who maybe don't want to make that pivot per se, but are looking for new work, it takes them, they stay unemployed for longer because it takes a longer time mm-hmm. to find work in the same sector.
Mm-hmm. Is that true? But Bill's story also reflects the fact that the community colleges were free. Tuition was free for him. And so the fact that he may have had resources and paid off his house, that's true. But anyone who's in a situation that you know can take advantage of a free education, those opportunities are going to be more and more prevalent.
Well, let's go to Remy, who's calling from Back Bay. You're on the air, Remy.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I manage a group of people. I manage a social club, and we run events. And I would much, so it's definitely not a white-collar position, but I would much rather have an older workforce. I've catered many, many years and had my own restaurant, and they just seem more eager and ready to learn, and there's no entitlement, which is, I find, a common problem now that's growing with young people. And the common sense, I don't understand where all the common sense went. The older group, to me, seems like they have skills where they can figure things out and they can problem solve better, even in the face of, you know, broken down technology or, you know, a situation like that.
Well, Remy, at any point in time, have you seen the opportunity to maybe have your older folks, you know, help impart those skills that you think are lacking in the younger people who you work with?
Sure. I try to have the older folks kind of mentor and do some training, and I certainly try to do that myself as a manager as I'm, you know, getting older. It seems to be lost. Like, you know, if the AV breaks down in an event, so, you know, I can take someone with me and say, okay, we have to work the room. We have to, you know, let's make sure everyone has their drinks. Let's make jokes. Let's problem solve. And they're kind of looking at me going, you know, when can I go home?
Well, Remy, thank you so much for your call. I'm going to stand here as the defender of young folks and say I know a whole bunch of people who would be able to work a room, no problem, who are less than 65 years old. But your point was well taken, Remy. Thank you so much. I want to take another call from Joe, who's calling from Charlestown. You're on the air, Joe.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My comment was just that I find it disturbing that, you know, that the Fed and I know you want to give positive signs about the economy is coming, and the president keep telling everybody how wonderful the economy is. And I have two people in my life, my mom, one of them right now, who's got a master's degree, fluent in another language. She's in her 50s, had been laid off from her job about 4 years ago and just cannot. They'll offer, Boston Public Schools for all the signs and everything Marty Walsh says about needing good people. They'll give her a substitute teaching job for $29,000 a year, but you can't find a full-time position, it feels like, in your 40s, 50s, and 60s once you've left your job that you've had for a while. So that's my comment, and I hope it gets better. So,
Joe, thank you so much for your call. Can you just respond to what Joe says? Because I think a lot of people feel this way because they're experiencing it.
Sure. But I think that behind that is the pervasive ageist attitudes, and we have a long way to go to correct those. And we hope our book will be part of a discussion going forward. But there's no doubt that people's ideas are very powerful. And yes, there are people who challenge those ideas, but it's a long way from that to a much more accepting notion, open ideas about what older people can do. And that's true of the people themselves. you know, we live in this culture which is pretty ageist. So, like Bill, he was able to go out and go to college because he had the thought that, yes, I can do that. But a lot of people have a cultural notion, oh, my gosh, you're over the hill, you're all dried up, and they might not take advantage of what's out there.
Hmm. Well, let's take another call. The phone line's really lighting up over this one. Lori is calling from Natick. You're on the air, Lori.
I just want to comment that I think people are staying longer in the workforce because companies are providing less employer-sponsored retirement plans. In the old days, there was defined benefit and defined contribution plans. Today, there's just 401k. And I think, you know, the retirement savings that we once anticipated just aren't there anymore.
Yeah, Lori, thank you so much for your call. We touched upon this point earlier, but I think it's a fundamental importance to so many people. Mm-hmm. With the aging of America and the new age of longevity, as you write, I mean, are we going to have to? I mean, underlying all this, I'm hearing maybe we need to rethink, retirement plans. Is Social Security going to support, the new age of longevity?
I think we do have to think, because this is a whole new world, and will the old rules work? What kind of things, what kind of policies do we have to put in place? I mean, I think we have to get really inventive, because it is true. People are staying longer, because if you're going to live to 90, that's a lot different than if you're going to live to 66.
Also, I think part of the presidential campaign this year is to increase Social Security benefits. At least some of the candidates are talking that way. And that seems to be a conversation that needs to be happening.
Hmm. Well, let's sneak one more call in here. So many people want to talk about this. I love it. Bill is calling from Cambridge. You're on the air, Bill.
Hi. I'm a baby boomer, so I'm in the demographic you're talking about. And I simply wanted to make the point that I think there are some industries where an aging workforce are actually holding back the evolution. That doesn't mean that my peer group can't stay on another 5-10 more years. But in real estate, we're still stuck in a pre-internet business model, and I think it's time to move on.
Mm, interesting point, Bill. Potential downside there, Rosalind and Carol?
Well, I think that when you have a workforce that's working together, you have, say, the younger people who might have some of the new ideas working with the older people, and not one group controlling or the other group controlling, then that kind of gets this sort of tension, positive tension, that can make things happen. So it's not always a downside to have the older people there, although it certainly could be if people aren't thinking about what's new.
Hmm. Well, there's so much more to discuss, and I'll let people know that they have the chance to discuss it with Rosalind and Carol, because they'll be at the Harvard Bookstore tomorrow night.
At
7 p.m. at the Harvard Bookstore. Always get the plug in. That's good.
Right.
7 o'clock at the Harvard Bookstore. We'll have information about that at our website, radioboston.org. Again, the new book is The Age of Longevity, Reimagining Tomorrow for Our New Long Lives, written by Rosalind Barnett and Carol Rivers. It's always great to have you on the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Great to be here.
We'll be back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Years ago, Malcolm Gladwell wrote a book called Blink. You've probably heard of it. It's the book where Gladwell assembles evidence in support of the idea that sometimes we make better choices unconsciously in the blink of an eye than we do after careful consideration, and that, quote, great decision makers are not those who process the most. So what do you think about this? What do you think about the idea of bringing the blink ethos to radiology and reading mammograms? Got your attention? Well, let us explain with Carrie Goldberg, editor of our Common Health blog. Hi there, Carrie.
Hey, Megan, I get the sense you're not a Gladwell fan.
Well, I'm on the fence. Let's
okay.
Put it that way.
Anyway, so yes, blink for mammograms. You know, that's what I thought of when I saw a really fascinating new study that just came out actually a few minutes ago in the journal The Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
Okay, so hot off the presses.
Right.
What does the study show?
So it basically shows that radiologists looking at mammograms developed the ability to know instinctively, like within a fraction of a second, literally in a split second, whether a breast has a tumor developing or not, and whether the woman who had the mammogram should be brought back for a closer look.
Okay, here, stop for a second. Mm-hmm. I do, I feel compelled to inject a healthy dose of skepticism here, as you detected earlier.
Yes.
I mean, what kind of tumors are we talking about? Are these well-developed ones?
No, because that would be too easy. That would be just obvious. This study purposely used subtle tumors. Here's how the senior author, Jeremy Wolf, puts it. He's the director of the Visual Attention Lab at Brigham and Women's Hospital.
We took a collection of images, half of them that had signs of cancer in them, half of them that didn't. And we flashed them for about half a second at radiologists and asked them simply to say, is this image possibly abnormal or not? And if they were just guessing in a half second, they would be just as likely to say abnormal to a normal one as to an abnormal one. But in fact, they could beat chance very reliably.
In fact, they beat chance a lot. He says the radiologists were right more like 75% of the time.
Okay, so that's impressive.
So that's impressive, but it gets even better. So the really surprising piece of this study is that when they showed the radiologists images of women who had cancer, but they didn't show a mammogram of the breast that had cancer. They showed a mammogram of the breast that did not have any detectable cancer according to the technology we have now. So the unconscious sense that radiologists had still picked up that there was something wrong, even in the opposite breast, the breast that had no cancer. Thus, Dr. Wolf says,
suggesting that there's something about the breasts of women who develop cancer that is abnormal. Even before there's a cancer there.
So, yeah, something global going on, right? Now, of course, this is just an initial study. It might not be borne out, but it's just so tantalizing that it might be possible to pick up the earliest signs of cancer even earlier than we do now.
Okay, wow. This is very interesting. But Carrie, we don't know what it is that the radiologists are seeing that's the sign that their unconscious is picking up.
Right. We don't know. But the study does report this other very interesting clue about what these radiologists are seeing that they're not even aware of. It found that the key seems to be in the fine detail of the images and not in sort of like the overall impressionistic sense of the image. So it's something about the detail of the fine lines they see in the image showing the fibrous structure of the breast. But like weirdly enough, the radiologists weren't very good at pointing to the exact spot where the problem was in this study. They were just really good at knowing that there was a problem.
Okay, but nevertheless, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong here, but it would be great to figure out how they are doing it, because I presume that could lead to better, more accurate mammograms.
Right. So that's what's so interesting about this study. And because if mammograms were more accurate, they'd be better at diagnosing cancer and also better at diagnosing what's not cancer. And, you know, about 10% of women are called back after a mammogram for a further look. And I can tell you from personal experience, that is really scary. So, and also, if we can figure out what the radiologists are seeing in that breast that does not have the tumor, that they somehow got a danger signal from, that could lead to this earlier cancer detection.
If we can figure out what the signal is, then computer scientists can tell the computer to look for it and potentially improve the computer's ability to do these sorts of tasks.
Because obviously we want computers to be able to do this, but it's hard to get a computer to do what a human brain does if you don't even know what the human brain is doing.
Okay, which right? In a sense brings us back to the whole blink analogy, because one of the reasons why I think that book was so popular is that it's amazing, mind-boggling even, to think about all the things that our brains are doing without us even knowing.
Right. And we want to be in conscious control, right? So we want to learn about what's going on unconsciously. But so reading about all this unconscious processing by these radiologists, it made me just wonder, what does this feel like to them? Like when they somehow just know that an image is bad.
Okay. Healthy skepticism here again. Yep. They don't just know. I mean, they're very well trained, highly educated, years of study and practice.
Yes. Absolutely. But, you know, it's also kind of like the Star Wars line, I feel a disturbance in the force, right? And that's what Dr. George Cushing told me. He's a radiologist at Mount Auburn Hospital in Cambridge, and he sees thousands of mammograms a year. And he also has a great dog analogy.
One of my colleagues once said this to me when he was teaching me how to be a radiologist, and he said, we're pointer dogs. And it's kind of true. We're hunters. We're looking for the thing that needs to get gotten. And it pulls your eye to it almost. It's very fast.
So it's almost like it becomes instinctive. But of course, it's different from being a pointer dog who's happy when it finds a bird, because this is a really bad thing that you're finding. Here's Dr. Cushing again.
So you've got this sort of split feeling of sadness for the fact that this is going to mean something terrible for her, and satisfaction because you did your job, and then a little bit of paranoia on the side because now what are you missing?
Hmm. Well, mm-hmm. Carrie, I'm the foil here this time, but
yep,
I do want to
okay.
point out that the subtitle of Malcolm Gladwell's book is The Power of Thinking Without Thinking. And honestly, I have to say it makes me a little uncomfortable as a patient to hear that radiologists could make split-second observations like this for a mammogram. I mean, I want my doctor to be staring long and hard at those images.
Oh, yes, 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 you do. And listen, let's make this really clear. This is not about what happens in your medical treatment. So you don't get diagnosed with cancer in a split second. It's a very, very careful process. This study was about trying to analyze what's going on in the brains of these expert radiologists so that we can exploit that knowledge for better medical care. And, you know, Jeremy Wolf points out that you could get the impression from reading Blink that you should make the decision on who to marry or whether you have cancer based on a first glimpse. And that would be a huge, huge, huge mistake because 75% is not a good enough hit rate for decisions like this.
Yeah, we want it to be up at like 99.9999999%.
Right.
Well, Carrie Goldberg, I'm going to call you because of your Star Wars reference earlier, the Obi-Wan Kenobi of health.
Thank you.
She's the editor of WBOR's Common Health blog. Carrie, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.